Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's about 7 seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and I've got a great lineup of guests sitting here in the studio waiting to come on right after National Native News is Maria Levischuk, who runs the Glory Hole and who's getting ready for the Empty Bowls benefit. We're going to talk to a magician who's coming to town. Richard Hatch will be at the Douglas Library at 3 p.m. on Saturday. We're going to give him a phone call and get him in here to tell us about it. Earlier this morning, I had the wonderful privilege of meeting Sean Harper, the Pillars of America speaker for Wednesday at noon at Centennial Hall, and we'll have a pre-recorded interview with Sean at about 3:30. And then closing out the show today, we'll have Kate Jensen come in to tell us about the ongoing Investigating Traditional Ecological Knowledge course that's been that's just about to conclude through JDHS and the University of Alaska Southeast. So stay tuned for all of that. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Navajo man says he's safe after running the Boston Marathon. He crossed the finish line about 24 minutes before the explosions, which killed and injured people Monday. Thomas Hatafali says he was entering the subway when he heard the blast. At first, he thought it was a train crash until later when he saw news about the bombs on television.
The scene and just watching it, you know, because they put everything more in detail here in Boston. And just to see, you know, just the scene, it's really awful.
Hatafali says it was overwhelming not being able to get in immediate contact with family and friends. He was out of touch with them for about 3 to 4 hours. After he talked to loved ones, word of his safety spread quickly through text messages, email, and Facebook. Hatafali is from Tuba City, Arizona. This was his 12th time running the Boston Marathon, and he plans to run it again next year. Officials in Massachusetts continue to investigate the bombings. So far, 3 people have been reported dead and more than 170 injured. Oral arguments began today in the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl. The court will examine if the child with a Cherokee father or the couple the girl's mother chose for adoption will be her permanent home. The girl's biological father is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. There are several issues tribes and Native organizations are watching in this case, including how it may impact future adoptions of Native children. The Oregon Senate has passed a bill that would loosen a new state policy that requires schools to erase Native American logos from uniforms, sports fields, trophy cases, and other items. KWSO's William Robbins has more.
Less than a year ago, the Oregon State School Board of Education imposed a statewide ban on Native American mascots in schools. The Education Board gave schools with Native American mascots until July 2017 to change them or risk losing state funding. Under a bill passed last week by the Oregon Senate, schools would be able to keep their Native American mascots as long as local tribes agree. A committee in Salem recently heard testimony on the bill to overturn the ban on names like Brazier Chiefs. Brenda Frank is a member of Oregon's Klamath tribe and spoke out against the use of Native names or imagery.
The best research that made this decision tells you that race-based mascots are wrong. They're just outright wrong.
Not everyone is in favor of the ban. Supporters of the mascots, including some tribal members, say they're a source of pride. The bill will now go to the Oregon House. For National Native News, I'm Will Robbins.
Some tribal communities nationwide need additional sanitation infrastructure and projects ranging from water main replacement to water tank maintenance. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov has details.
There are about $2.9 billion worth of sanitation development projects in tribal communities across the U.S. And Wyoming has 33 projects that add up to just under $16.5 million, according to the U.S. Indian Health Service. Ronald Ferguson directs the IHS Division of Sanitation Facilities. He says Wyoming is in a better position than some other areas.
A lot of our larger needs are on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona, and because it's a very large land area with lots of people, and then in Alaska. But we also see a lot of need in Oklahoma. A lot of the infrastructure has been put in Wyoming and in Montana through the years. There's still needs, but I think we've addressed that with time.
IHS recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of the Interior, and the Department of Agriculture. The pact should help the agencies better share resources to get the projects done more efficiently. IHS is still unsure about which projects will be funded in 2013. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhurov.
On this day in 1976, the United National Indian Tribal Youth Organization, or UNITY, was incorporated as a nonprofit organization in Oklahoma. It supports leadership development among Native American youth. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
About 6 seconds after 3 o'clock, you're in tune, or 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, 6 seconds. Everybody reset their clocks. 6 minutes after 3, and you're in tune with KTOO News. My first two guests are here to tell us about the Empty Bowls benefit, which is coming up to raise a little cash for the Glory Hole, which is badly in need of it, as always. Of course, Maria Levischuk is here. She is the person who basically is in charge, but she brought with her operations manager, did you say?
Outreach coordinator.
Outreach coordinator Kyle Rennick is here with us. So the two of them are going to tell us a little bit about this great event, which comes up every year at this time, where you can go over to Centennial Hall, join the fairly rapidly moving line, unless it gets a little bogged down sometimes when someone is standing for a long time deciding which bowl it's going to be.
Although there will be two tables this year of bowls, so the lines should be moving very efficiently.
So in case there is one listener out there in Radioland who has never been to this event, what happens here is that a number of local potters make bowls. Maria collects them all. They go on tables in Centennial Hall. After you pay your fee at the door or pick up your tickets in advance, you get in a line, and then as you come in, you can look at these bowls and choose one. And you don't have to eat your soup out of it. You can just have it wrapped up and take it home, but you can if you want to, I suppose. But then there's some soup to eat.
So there will actually be about 20 different soups prepared by most of the local restaurants. We have soups from Island Pub. We have soups from Douglas Cafe, the Baranoff, El Sombrero, some new restaurants like Bee's Bistro and the Rookery and the Rockwell. And then, of course, Rainbow Foods and the Hanger and the Sandpiper and Zen and Broiler and Abby's Kitchen and Mikasa and Savannah Cafe, which is this new Thai place. So just lots of soup.
And don't forget some soup cooked by the Glory Hole Kitchen as well. We have some good food down there for sure. And we have a couple of guest chefs that are going to be cooking for us this year.
Yeah, we're going to have a Cuban Pantage soup prepared by Rogelio Cardo. It should be very delicious and also vegetarian. And then we have some amazing bean soups and this really delicious creamy potato leek soup.
You brought samples, right?
Yes, we're right here.
Oh, so good.
Okay. So now, in addition to soup, we have music.
I will have music by Tom Locker, who is so graciously volunteered to play for us again. And then Mary and Greg DeSmet will be playing in the lobby to entertain people who are standing in line.
In line, yeah.
The Full Circle Music folks.
Yeah, cool. And then you have an MC or someone who kind of runs the event and keeps it moving.
Yeah, it should be very exciting this year. K2's very own Christy Chambor is going to MC, so it should be really, really great.
Yeah.
We'll also have some really delicious bread from Wild Oven, so everybody should come for that. And fresh baked cookies for dessert.
All you can eat fresh baked cookies.
All right. Who's baking the cookies?
Oh, everybody's baking cookies. Who is not baking cookies?
Okay. So millions of bakers.
At least definitely dozens.
Yeah, okay, dozens of bakers. All right. So all of this money that's going to... Oh, and then you've also got two auctions going on at the same time.
We're
here,
going
right?
to try to have a live dessert auction this year. I have to say that I think that last year we had an amazing dessert auction and people walked out with some really great desserts that were amazingly reasonably priced. Like there was a six-layer German chocolate cake with a raspberry ganache frosting, which went for like $35. So if you want a good dessert, this is a place to go.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so soup, cookies, music, bowls, great MC. The event is not horribly expensive. The tickets are on sale right now, several places, right?
I think it's very reasonably priced. Mm-hmm. People, tickets are on sale at Hearthside, both downtown and in Nuwali, and at the Glory Hall. And it's $30, and for $30 you get all-you-can-eat soup, all-you-can-eat cookies, all-you-can-eat freshly baked, wet day, wild oven bread, in addition to, of course, a beautiful, beautiful handmade bowl that somebody made.
Yeah. Now the bowls this year, some of them are in the past you've mostly done pottery thrown bowls, but you have some different materials this time.
We have some beautiful wooden bowls made by wood turners, Don Gottschall, Neil Slotnick, Kevin Miller, and others. And they are pretty amazing. We have some ash bowls, we have some alder bowls, we have some aspen bowls. I mean, it really looks really cool because it really displays the amazing characteristics of the wood that we actually have around here. Like, I believe the ash bowls came from the ash that was fallen by the cemetery last year. So, and the golden knots, it's really cool looking. And then we do have beautiful ceramic bowls from the canvas, from Paul Volcker's, from the UAS ceramics program. So, and many, many other potters.
Yeah.
Can you pay double and get two bowls?
Definitely. You can pay triple and get three bowls. You can pay quadruple and get four bowls. And I think if you buy nine tickets, you can maybe get 9.5 bowls. I'm not sure.
The last one won't hold soup very well at all. What were you going to say, Kim?
I was just going to say, you know, from the bowls to the bread to the musicians and the MC, it just is a great community event. It comes from so many different parts, and it all comes together on Sunday night.
Yeah. So this is Sunday night, 5 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the money that's being raised for this is going to go a lot of different places. The Glory Hole is the recipient, but you do many, many things with the money that you receive.
We have been doing many different things, and we have been really kind of trying to expand our services in order to take care of our clients in a better way and try to kind of figure out how to get folks to not be at the Glory Hole year after year or be on South Franklin Street year after year after year after year. So we started doing case management. We are doing outreach. We now have a labor and wellness program. We are also, continue on serving the meals that we've been serving. Last year we served about 56,000 meals. They're still providing emergency shelter. Last year we provided over 9,000 safe shelter nights. And we are giving out food boxes still and doing like essential services like laundry and showers. And so we're kind of continuing to do all of that. So the money that we are hoping to raise from this event really help us with our operating funds, because it's really hard to get money just for operating funds.
What's your client count look like?
Right now we are sleeping, I think, 44 people upstairs, which is one over. They've been over for a while, and it's kind of, the numbers are declining now that it's warmer outside. We fed 55 people for lunch today. I'm not sure how many we'll have for dinner.
Yeah. Is it usually like, what's a typical dinner? Do you have stats?
The dinner is actually, that's the most amazing thing is about the Glory Hole, is all the volunteers. So each night, a different, either a faith-based organization or just a group of people takes over and they cook dinner. Mm-hmm. So, Northern Lights Church cooks every second Tuesday and every third Tuesday. Chapel by the Lake cooks every first Friday and so on and so forth. And pretty much like every single faith-based organization in town comes in and they bring the food. They bring their like wonderful energy. They bring all of our wonderful volunteers and they cook really, really nice meals. And the meals are really diverse. Like we have Filipino food. We have like adobo and pancit. And then we just have, baked chicken and mashed potatoes. They have hamburgers, just all sorts of things like that.
Pizza night.
Pizza night, very popular. But while the volunteers are cooking, the kitchen has to be staffed with a Glory Hole employee at all times.
Mm-hmm. So are there any slots open if someone wants to volunteer to pick up a night lunch?
Saturday and Sunday, and I believe either the second or they should call me at 586-4159, but we do have some
weekend
spots. Say
that number again, real slow.
586-4159.
586-4159. If somebody's interested in offering any assistance to the Glory Hole, you can call Maria. Kyle, what is the outreach coordination job?
It spans a wide variety of tasks. It can be anything from walking around out on the streets to the folks who aren't in the at the glory hole for various reasons, and kind of assisting them, talking with them, providing them with food and beverages outside on the streets, to working with people on their housing needs, helping somebody move into an apartment, or helping somebody apply for Social Security disability, helping someone reconnect with a family member down south that they haven't spoken with in years. The job varies every day, and it basically involves all the things that Maria would like to do if she weren't so busy keeping the whole place running.
Well, welcome aboard the staff. You've only been with the Glory Hole for a fairly short time, right?
Yeah. Not nearly as long as Maria. Just about a year now, so happy to be there.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Let's say it one more time. The Glory Hole Benefit Empty Bowls event is at 5 o'clock Sunday night. Tickets are on sale at Hearthside. You said someplace else had tickets as well.
At the Glory Hole. You can always come by.
Okay, good. All right. And you get, for that $30 fee, you get a bowl, you get all the soup you can eat, you get all the cookies you can mash down, and you get a chance to bid on desserts and things like that while you're sitting there munching your Daniel's Wild Oven bread. A great event, folks. Go buy a ticket right now. Just, you know, put up the computer, get on there, tell somebody that you need a ticket for it. A little appropriate music to go out with here. Thanks.
Thank you, Pat.
Get off the bus and I can see my breath. The air is so cold that you could freeze to death. I turn up my collar and the wind starts to blowing. Sky turns gray and it begins to snow. Put down my head, it's only two blocks more. I make it to my house and then I open the door. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like soup, soup. Soup, soup. When my dad was a kid in my grandma's home, she taught him how to start with the old soup bone. You put the water, carrot, celery, and onions in the pot. It only takes a little of whatever you got. There ain't no way to hurry, and my grandma would remind, anything with waiting for is gonna take time. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like winter in our house. It smells like soup, soup. Soup, soup. All day long I hear it bubbling in the pot. Sneak up to the lid, be careful, it's hot. Lift up the corner and I take a little sniff, and then I close my eyes and take a great big whiff. I go and get a tablespoon to steal a little taste. I got a big soup smile all over my face. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like winter at our house. It smells like steam soup, chicken soup, macaroni, cream of broccoli, and minestrone, alligator soup, tomato soup, chowder made of clam, miso soup, and mushroom soup, split pea with ham, bouillon, scallion, tonka guy with lemongrass, matzo ball, chili bean, cream of soup. So it doesn't ever matter, let the cold winds blow, let the rivers free, and if there's 3 feet of snow, from my dad and from my grandma, it's what I got. Put a whole lot of love in that old black pot. In my mind I see a little boy, a distant winter day. He's standing in my door and I can hear him say, smells like winter in our house.
Yeah, it smells like winter at Centennial Hall this Sunday when we have the soup benefit for the Glory Hole, the Empty Bowl soup benefit. So go buy a ticket, $30. Enjoy all the soup you can eat and help a really worthy cause. My next guest is going to bring an act to Juneau, and he's doing two performances, one on Saturday at the Douglas Library, And then Tuesday, he's at the Jack. With me is Richard Hatch, who's coming in by telephone. And Richard took his two graduate degrees from Yale University and decided that it would be more fun to make things appear and disappear than blow things up. So that's what he's been doing. Welcome, Richard.
Hi, Pat. Thank you.
Yeah, good.
Good to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about where are you, by the way?
Right now I'm in Logan, Utah, a college town in northern Utah, not too far from the Idaho-Wyoming borders. And that's where I moved about 2.5 years ago with my wife to be closer to my parents. My dad's a retired emeritus physics professor here at Utah State University, and my wife and I had spent the last 30 years in Houston.
Yeah.
And decided it was time to be closer to my folks at this time in all our lives. So I've been acclimating to that and enjoying the changes.
So you became a magician in 1983, I guess, was when you sort of went full-time with this, right?
That's right. I had been a graduate student in physics at Yale, which is where I met my wife, Rosemary. She was at the School of Music studying violin, working on and ultimately got a Master of Music, and I got a Master of Science and Master of Philosophy, but in physics. I was in a phase when I went there where I was not doing any magic. I had given it up cold turkey, more or less, as an undergraduate. Went to school in Minnesota at Carleton College and had given it up more or less out of frustration. I wanted to do it professionally. I didn't have any role models. I thought it was a totally unrealistic fantasy, and so I just gave it up. And then when I was at graduate school, I started to pick it up again. I met some performers who were doing it full-time and reasonably successfully, and I started to rethink my whole career plans, thinking, well, you know, let me give this a try for a year or two. If it doesn't work out, I can always go back to physics. And that was, gosh, more than 30 years ago now. I'd have a hard time going back to physics. At the time, it seemed like it'd be an easy thing to do. But string theory, I have no idea what they're talking about.
But you do.
That's real magic.
You do things with string, though, right?
I do, actually. I should tie that into that. But very different. And yeah, I want to make it clear that I don't really violate the laws of nature. I only apparently do so.
Well,
the magic that happens takes place in the minds of the audience, not so much on stage. That's how they interpret what I do and say that makes it look like it's impossible.
Well, at one point in your career, you were part of a thing called Magic, the Science of Wonder, that was held at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. And there's a really wonderful YouTube that I would direct anyone to kind of get a preview of what Richard can do. There is a little, I think it's probably about 3 or 4 minutes of video of you working with some silver cups and some white balls, and you are amazing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was a wonderful exhibit that ran for about 6 months in Houston at the Houston Museum of Natural Science, and it used magic as the focal point. There were artifacts, and I lent some things from my collection, mostly books and posters, but they had props from Houdini and Blackstone and posters from various performers. But they also wanted to talk about how it is that our minds allow us to be deceived, how it is that we perceive things and misinterpret what we perceive. And they also involved live performances. It was a really great exhibit. It ran for about 6 months, and I was kind of hoping it might travel to other communities, but I think it was just too expensive to mount, so it wasn't really practical for it to travel.
I think you brought your academic background into the world of magic a little bit. You have I think you've translated several works on magic from German.
I have.
And
the
probably
first
Italian
thing I did
as well.
Nothing in Italian. I wish that were in my skill set. I have translated probably the best known to magicians, and only to magicians, is a 4-volume set of books called Card College in English. That has a 5th volume that I had nothing to do with. The author, who is very fluent in English himself, he's Swiss-German, decided to write it directly in English and eventually translated it back into German himself. But they're a very successful course on card manipulation techniques for entertainment purposes only, that is regarded kind of as the standard.
Not the Las Vegas circuit, huh?
No. Not for for achieving purposes, although I'm very interested in that. Deceptions all share certain common aspects, and so what is useful to a card cheat might be equally useful to a magician in a different context.
And one of the common themes of several movies about magicians that have come out in the recent years have been the intense competition for having the best act. Do you experience any of that, or is that just all for the movies?
You know, certainly there's competition. And there have been some recent movies that one recently that didn't do as well as I think had been hoped. The Burt Wonderstone movie with Stephen Carell and Jim Carrey involves some of that. I don't see that so much. I try and do performances that are so different, I think, I hope, that I'm kind of competing with myself in a way. The Las Vegas kind of acts with smoke and mirrors and what we call grand illusion, that's a very different market, and I enjoy seeing that kind of performance, and especially when it's done well, and I enjoy being baffled by that kind of performance. But mine is more a 19th century kind of tradition from the Victorian era. Magicians would characterize my specialty as kind of parlor magic, a more intimate performance, not really suitable for a grand venue with thousands of audience members. We did a performance I was a little worried about. We had 600 and after banquet thing, and there were things like the cups and balls that I was going to eliminate. But they said, no, we'll have a couple of cameras and put it up on big screens, and it worked out beautifully. In fact, I think it might have even been better because they could get that intimacy, but in that big room, and could the cameraman had watched a couple of performances, so knew where to zoom in and highlight things. It really worked out great.
Now, you and your wife have appeared together in some settings where she's played the violin as a part of the...
And that's what we'll be doing in Juneau on Saturday at 3 o'clock at the library. Most of that will be a solo performance of mine, but it'll finish with a telling of a story that's a Japanese story using a Japanese feat, but she'll accompany that on her violin, playing a transcription of a violin Japanese piece by the great composer Michio Miyagi, who called it Haru no Umi, the Sea of Spring, and it works wonderfully with this particular piece. That one won't involve piano accompaniment. On Tuesday night at the Jack, we'll be doing a performance with our son Jonathan, who's a pianist, so that'll involve, there'll be musical solos and magical solos, but there'll also be probably about 50% of the performance is ensemble pieces where the magic and music are happening simultaneously. So if you can view it as the magic is kind of choreographed to the music and each kind of supports the other. And that's what makes it kind of a unique challenge because I'm not aware of anyone else currently doing anything like that.
I'm kind of embarrassed here. I just realized that my notes don't tell me what time your show is on at the Jack on Tuesday night. Are you starting at 7?
That's at 7 o'clock, yeah. And it'll run till about 8:30.
Okay.
And I know tickets, I think, are available on their website, and they also have a Facebook page dedicated to it. Mm-hmm. And I think their number is 586 Arts, I think you can call
it. Yes, that's correct, yeah. Okay, good. So it's Tuesday night at the Jack, 7 o'clock. You'll need tickets for that performance. But is the Saturday Douglas Library show, are you kind of aiming that toward children?
Primarily, after 3 o'clock, that is a free performance. That performance will be lasting about 40 minutes. It'll be mostly, as I say, without music. The very last piece, the story that I've written, Tarleson, the Fisherman and the Weeping Willow Tree, that will have Rosemary accompanying me on her violin. And in both those performances, I will be doing the cups and balls a little bit differently than they'll see online because I will have two audience members holding a special board on which I perform it. So two kids in that case and probably also in the Tuesday performance will be right up close with the magic happening right under their noses, and that helps to project what's happening to the rest of the audience, so it's a lot of fun.
May I have a volunteer from the audience, please? Right.
There you go.
Richard, thank you so much. I hope you enjoy your visit to Juneau.
Looking forward to it very much.
Yeah, we'll be looking forward to having you here Saturday at the Douglas Library, 3 p.m. free show aimed primarily at kids. There will be a call for volunteers from the audience. And then Tuesday evening, tickets available for the show at the Jack. So give a call, get a ticket, go online, get a ticket at the Jack, and enjoy a show of magic. And it's mixed with music at the Jack, right?
Yes, and the music is classical music, but short pieces, and I think everybody will enjoy it.
Richard, I welcome you to Juneau.
Thank you.
You bet.
Look forward to our visit. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye. We're talking to Sean Harper at about 11 o'clock in the morning because he has other things that he had to do today, and so we pre-recorded this. Welcome to Juneau, Sean.
Thank you.
And we've already kind of established the fact with the big sign on the front of Centennial Hall that you're going to be the speaker tomorrow at the Pillars of America series, and we thank you very much for coming to Juneau and for bringing your message to us.
Well, you know what? I love the opportunity. This is my first time in Alaska, and thus far I am having a wonderful time. You guys have been you guys have gone to a whole new level of hospitality. You set the bar real high for anywhere else I go from after this.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, because we really try. We're known somehow for welcoming people to Juneau, and So thank you for taking care of that. And of course, with you here is Karen Wright, who's part of the group that brought you up here. Can you tell us a little bit about how this all comes about?
You bet. I'm a member of the Glacier Valley Rotary Club. The Glacier Valley Rotary Club has had a mission for a number of years now, where we bring in world-class speakers to Juneau so that they can present in front of both school kids and business owners and members of the public who would like to be inspired. And each of the speakers have a unique story all of their own, but they also have a common thread, and that common thread is that they have overcome tremendous obstacles in their life and gone on to persevere and to exceed and excel in ways that truly are inspirational. And that's why we brought Shaman, because he's done exactly that. We have starting tomorrow on Wednesday, April 24th, we've got Sean speaking. And then on May 1st, we have Josh Sundquist. And on May 8th, we have Captain J. Charles Plum speaking. The speakers will start, and we want everybody to come and be at Centennial Hall about a quarter after 11 in the morning. Doors will open. We'll get everybody seated, fed lunch, and really give you an opportunity to listen to somebody who's got a message that will reach down and not just touch you, but grab you.
Now, half the audience is going to be high school students and junior high school students that have been kind of selected by their teachers to have the opportunity to come to this. The rest are members of the Rotary Club, members of the community, and so forth. So, Sean, I guess my first question to you is, I've seen you, seen some of your talks to like high school assemblies, and I've seen some of your talks to groups that ask you to come and give a motivational speech. I've seen some of your Christian presentations. How do you approach this mixed audience of businessmen and members of the community and junior high school students and high school students?
Well, upon arriving, I began asking questions. And I've quietly interviewed about four or five people I've seen. I woke up yesterday morning talking to people, asking questions to actually define the mission. This can get me in trouble, but I think I'm spot on this one, and that is creating an epicenter for change. Why are we here? Why is the older people here, the younger people here, students, people of the Rotary Club, which I think, by the way, is an amazing organization. We are here to, in my opinion, solidify legacy for this awesome community, that we are passing the torch, we are inspiring, we are motivating people not only to affect but to infect the entire community for change for the better.
Do you bring to this such a wide variety of things? You start out having to overcome like four major obstacles in your life that as a young man when you were a young kid, really. And I guess then, having done that, you go all the way up to being a star in a football team and then go into business for yourself. Can you talk a little bit about how you bring all those things together when you find that mission and then put something behind it?
Well, I'm like a sponge, and so I take in everything. I absorb everything. I don't hear things. I absorb things. I absorb communities, and then I allow them to push, and whatever they need comes out. My actual capacity, whenever they push, whenever they hit, wherever I sense is what then I will actually pull from, and then I will hand to them because it was given to me. I was blessed by it. And so I'm able to just be a conduit of love. If it's hope, if it's grace, if it's motivation, if it's inspiration, which is different from motivation, or if it's a or if it's a proverbial kick in the pants. Whatever you pull on me is what I'm going to deliver.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, it might be needed for some parts of the community. Yeah. I'm not sure. Nothing comes to mind, but the thought is there. I guess the other thing that I wanted to ask you is, when I've watched some of the things that you've done, I really see... I said three different people, but you corrected me and said three aspects of the same person. I guess my question is, with all of these multiple kind of things that you can bring to bear, how do you know when to switch? How do you know when this one's going to be the right one and that one's going to be the right one?
Listen, I have learned how to listen, to not only listen naturally, but to listen spiritually, and just to hear what's happening, to be able to see. I've been blessed to just hear things, to see things. A person can make, like example, I actually interviewed a guy this morning, 21 years of age, and he's going around and, you know, and he spent 3 minutes complaining about the lack of opportunities. Things aren't working here, this, and all they do is burn this big, huge man, and they hang out, and the kids just went on, and it's just complaining and complaining, and then I asked them a question, because I heard something. I asked him, I said, so how can we change that? He paused for like 45 seconds, and he said, you know what? No one's ever asked me that question, but I'm thinking to myself, no, you've never asked yourself that question. And so I challenged him. I said, you got 5 minutes to come up with a list of ways to make things better for here in the youth. 5 minutes later, he has some amazing ideas. And so I've been blessed to just listen, not only for the opportunity, but listen for the answer.
When I first met you, which is just a few minutes ago, you're a big guy, but I was amazed at how gentle you are.
I'm not doing a good job.
No. There's something in there, and I think what it was okay. I was watching you listen to me. It was probably what I was sensing there, anyway.
Yeah.
But you are a real contrast of two or three different things. When I see that big body, I think step aside. But then the next minute you smile and I'm okay.
Yeah.
So, I guess one of the questions that I have for you is, You do a lot of this stuff with youth. Do you get any feedback? Is there a time when you know that somebody got changed because of something you did up there?
You know, I actually shared this story earlier. I was in Nashville, Tennessee some years back, and a kid came up to me, and he said, are you Mr. Harper? I said, yeah. And then he proceeded for about 2 minutes thanking me and how I was able to help create change in his life. He said he had saw me speak several years ago. The most amazing part of that story is that not only has his life changed, but now he's married and he has kids. But what blew me away was that he reached into his back right pocket, pulled out his wallet, and he pulled out my football card. And he said,
wow.
You were at my school in North Carolina, and that message really changed my life. Thank you. And I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, at the Embassy Suites Hotel.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, wow, a different state. But to be able, as I mentioned earlier, to be able to plant seeds under which the shade trees you may never sit under is an absolute blessing. We are all here. Every single one of us is here because somebody at some point in time paved the way or created the capacity for opportunities for you.
Now, one of the things I heard you say in one of your high school moments, and everybody needs to watch this video because of the quiet. Those kids were not breathing when you were talking to them. They were so intent on what you were saying. But one of the things you said to them was that they needed to find out what they were put here for.
Right.
And to do that thing. I think that's a core message of something that you're talking about here.
Yeah. I will also mention this again because I think I mentioned it in the newspaper, is that the DNA that's in the butterfly is also in the caterpillar.
Mm.
It's the same person. It's a manifestation of the same individual. So you are here for a season, and you're here for a reason. And it's up to you, through adversity, through pain, through struggle, through triumph, defeats, and setbacks, to manifest why you are really here, to live your life as a victor and not as a victim.
Now, no fair answering this question, Juno, because you haven't talked here yet. Where's the most exciting place you ever delivered your talk, one of your talks?
I don't remember.
I
don't remember because I don't think like that.
Okay.
I don't know. The most exciting place I've ever been to enjoy, well, then that's a different mindset. It's like asking an NFL football player, which, you know, I was NFL, what's the most exciting place you ever played a game? We're like, you know, we fly in, we beat each other to death, and we fly out. So I'm mission-minded, so I'm not really in the mode of enjoying and, you know, loving and, you know, ha-ha. I'm here to execute. I'm here to assassinate bad character and choices, and then I'm gone. Now, I've been at some beautiful places in the world, like Cape Town, South Africa, and Sedona, Arizona. Yeah. Newport Beach is my favorite, but, yeah.
Is there any of those places that you can remember where your audience responded more strongly than other places?
I can't remember.
So the response is just from the people?
Well, no. I mean, I can't remember because I don't pay attention to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people love me. Some people are like, well, you know I get an email and a letter. You know?
Yeah. When did you know that you could... that you could turn people on like this, that you could hear them and then feed it back to them and make them move? Where'd you discover that?
I discovered that gift. It was in sociology class, in S210 at Indiana University. And I was speaking about the Vestarian role, and that's a sociological term. And at the end of class, I was walking, and a young lady walked up to me. And she said, Sean, do you pay attention when people are looking at you? Or have you noticed how people look at you when you talk? I said, no, I've never paid attention. She said, pay attention next time. The next time I was speaking, I watched people to actually turn in their chair just to hear me speak. And I said, you know what? I believe that God has blessed me with a gift. And so I'm just trying to be a good steward of it to the best of my ability.
Well, we're going to get a chance to see that stewardship Wednesday at we're supposed to be there at 11:15, and you're going to start speaking at 12 o'clock. And I don't know if there are tickets left available.
There
or
are
not.
Tickets left available.
Good,
you
okay.
can get tickets either at the door or at Hearthside Books. If you buy the set of three tickets, it's going to cost you $90. If you buy one ticket, it'll cost you $35.
Well, having listened to Sean here and listened to Sean deliver some of these things, I can tell you right now, if you go tomorrow at 11 or at noon, this guy's going to get up and rock you. He is amazing, an amazing speaker, and he's going to move the house.
And we definitely would love for people to come. If you're listening to this, you want to hear more, and you want to be able to experience the message that Sean's got to give firsthand, we really encourage you to come over to Centennial Hall tomorrow. Come in 11:15, be seated by 11:30, and you'll have a great lunch plus a fantastic message.
Outstanding. Sean,
yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
No, I appreciate it, and looking forward to tomorrow's talk.
Well, have fun.
Hello, I'm Charles Wallace, and I play the character of Number Two in the world premiere of The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry by award-winning poet-playwright Marcus Gartley at Perseverance Theater. Original and strikingly powerful, the play merges myth, history, and bold humor to tell the story of black Seminole freedmen whose passions and desires rock the foundation of their community. See it first in Juneau, May 3rd to the 26th. Tickets at perseverancetheater.org, Hearthside Books, The Jack, or 463-TIXS.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 23rd of April, 2013. It's the birthday of Roy Orbison, 1936, born Vernon, Texas. Went to college, studied geology, but when his classmate Pat Boone signed a record deal, Roy Orbison decided to try that too. Moved to Memphis, formed a band, the Teen Kings, and his career took off in 1960 when he wrote and recorded the song Only the Lonely. One day, Roy Orbison asked his wife, Claudette, if she needed any money for her trip to Nashville, and Orbison's partner, Bill Deese, said, Pretty woman never needs any money. And 40 minutes later, Roy Orbison had written, Oh, Pretty Woman. It's the birthday of Vladimir Nabokov, born in St. Petersburg, Russia, 1899, to a well-to-do family. Novelist, author of Lolita, wrote his first 9 novels in Russian, then began writing in English, though he mourned the loss of his native tongue. A collector of butterflies who believed that had it not been for the Bolshevik Revolution which kicked him out of Russia, he would have become not a writer, but a lepidopterist. And today is the day traditionally held to be the birthday of William Shakespeare in Stratford-upon-Avon in Warwickshire, England. His father, John, was a glove maker and an alderman. His mother, Mary Arden, was a landed heiress. Young William went to the local grammar school, learned Latin and Greek there, but grammar school was the extent of his formal education, which led to people assuming that he never could have written the plays. He never could have written so knowledgeably about history and politics and foreign countries on just a grammar school education. It is known that when he was 18, he married Anne Hathaway, who was older and who was pregnant. She was 26. She gave birth to a daughter, Judith, 6 months later. Shakespeare moved to London around 1588. It's thought he may have been on the run from deer poaching charges in Stratford. And he began his career as an actor and a playwright. By 1594, he was also a managing partner of the Lord Chamberlain's Men, a very popular theatrical troupe in London. In 1611, he retired to Stratford, made out his will, and died on or around his birthday in 1616, his body buried in the Church of the Holy Trinity in Stratford, under the epitaph, Good friend, for Jesus' sake forbear to dig the dust, enclose it here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones, and cursed be he who moves my bones. Shakespeare, who wrote 38 plays, 154 sonnets, a couple of long narrative poems, created unforgettable characters, and, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, coined 3,000 new words and contributed many phrases to the English language. It was Shakespeare who gave us a fool's paradise, a sorry sight, dead as a doornail, Greek to me, come what may, eaten out of house and home, forever and a day, heart's content, slept a wink, love is blind, night owl, wild goose chase, and into thin air. Here's a poem for today by Grace Paley, entitled Certain Days. On certain days I am not in love, and my heart turns over, crowding the lungs for air, driving blood in and out of the skull, improving my mind, working muscles to the bone, dashing resonance out of a roaring sea at my nerve endings. Not much is needed, air, good sense, power, a noisy taking in and a loud giving back. Then my heart, like any properly turned motor, takes off in sparks, dragging all that machinery through the blazing day like grass, which our Lord knows I am. Certain Days, a poem by Grace Paley, from Begin Again, Collected Poems, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings.
Theater at Latitude 58 presents Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
Follow Alice and all the critters to Wonderland in their fateful game of croquet with the Queen of Hearts, where they very nearly lose their heads.
Performance is April 26th through 28th at McPheeters Hall, Friday and Saturday nights at 7, Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 2. Tickets from cast members or at the door.
It's just 11 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore hosting today for Juneau Afternoon, and I have in the studio with me two young ladies who are in the final days of a very interesting dual enrollment course that was offered through the University of Alaska and the Juneau school system called Investigating Traditional Ecological Knowledge. And with me are Elia Crum and Megan Johnson. Welcome, girls.
Hello.
Hi. And also in the studio with me are some of the people who worked on the program. I'm looking all over my notes here. Kate Jensen is here. She's from Gold Belt Heritage Institute. They were the ones who sponsored the program. Also with her is Henry Hopkins, who was part of the instructional process. He's with the Juneau School District, I believe, right? And Edward Hotch, who's he says he was sort of a helper, but I understand he also was part of the food too. Didn't you bring in some of the fish, as I understand it? Okay, well, I want to turn right to the girls here, because this program that you kind of got involved in is a really wonderful thing that I don't know if could happen outside of Southeast Alaska. Can you describe the course just a little bit to us?
Well, during the class, we've been learning the difference between Western science and Tlingit science, and it turns out some of us have finally found out that there's not really that big of a difference. It's just the language that's intercoursing with it now.
So, now you said when we were talking before the mics came open, we were talking about the fact that sometimes the elders would tell you a story, and then Henry would come in and kind of interpret that story for you. Can you describe that process a little bit?
Well, we had like someone like David Kutzik come, and he would tell us a Tlingit story of how the Tlingits would see the glaciers moving, and they'd have to like move away. And then we'd have a teacher come in and talk about how the glaciers would move and form the land. Or we'd have Henry come in, and he talked about the Tlingit canoes and how they were really scientific.
Henry, when you would come in and do that sort of thing now, had you heard the stories before, or were you kind of, was this, how was the rehearsal factor, I guess is what I'm looking
for? Well, some of these stories I'd heard before, and some stories were new to me, and basically my job was to pick out all the science that exists in these Tlingit stories. And it's actually fairly easy to do once you realize that there's really a whole lot of overlap between traditional ecological knowledge and Western science.
So the focus was on ecological science. We talked a little bit about what you might do next. I'm curious what this process of studying these things from two viewpoints, what kinds of vistas that opened up for you? What do you see as your next move here?
Well, I still want to continue going to the Path to Excellence camp that I've started before I became a freshman in high school, and it was really fun to relearn some of the things that I knew from when I was little and relearn some things that I just learned from the class and the camp altogether.
How many students were in this class?
There were 14.
14 of you? Okay. Mixed boys and girls? All together, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And as a group, I guess what I'm wondering is, how did this fit into the rest of your academic schedule? Did you see ties between what you were doing in this class and what was going on in the rest of your school time? Were there relationships?
Yeah, there were. I mean, I really understand the question.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess what I was looking for was whether or not maybe something that came out in this class, if you were taking a math class or a history class or an English class or something like that, did you see any places where there was kind of an overlap? Was there something that came from this class that you'd see in the other class? Or was it more or less a separate thing by itself?
It was definitely a lot different than all my other classes. I haven't really taken any, like, Tlingit classes, so this was much more involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you speak the Tlingit language at all?
I can speak a little bit, and I can understand a little bit of Tlingit.
Okay, so when they would tell the stories, you were tuned in a little bit to the
language? Yeah, a little bit, but yeah.
But you said that when you heard a story, they would lapse into Tlingit to make a part of it, and then they'd translate it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that made it clear to you when the translation came, right?
Yeah.
Somebody who's been on the program has talked about the idea that there are ideas that you can say in Tlingit that are very difficult to say in English, that the languages don't have a total overlap, and that part of the way of understanding this knowledge is you have to speak Tlingit or learn some Tlingit in order to do it. Do you think that's true?
Well, for me, in my opinion, I don't really think so. Then again, I grew up with it, and to me, it's not really that hard of a language. It's just pronouncing some of the words in Tlingit that I was taught when I was younger.
Yeah, but you don't find concepts that you can't really translate across into English?
No, not really.
Not so much. Okay. Okay. Let me think. Kate, can you talk a little bit about how this program got started? This was sort of a one-off, right? You haven't been doing this a whole bunch.
This co-sponsored class is a branch off of what Megan referred to earlier, the Path to Excellence Academy. Yeah. It was to provide support to both Alaskan Native and non-Native students throughout the school year, creating opportunities for them to learn Tlingit science as well as Western science together. So we're hoping that this is a bridge that kind of makes that pathway possible for them to feel there's a community in the school.
So I'm interested in how this process got started within the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. Who made the decision to offer a course?
Well, our executive director and the president of the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation work on multiple projects to kind of bridge relationships with the school district. And this was just one more opportunity to do that. Say, we're going to come into the school, we're going to come after school, we're going to make this place feel like a community for the students.
So, girls, if you had a chance to do another course like this, I know you're going back into the Path to Excellence program. If you had a chance to take another course like this, would you do it?
I would, definitely.
Yeah, I would.
And can you think about what you would like to go into? What more would you like it to be? What would be the next thing that you'd want to do?
For me, I would like to get more into the history because I've been taught some of the things of what happened in the past between them, but I want to get further into it more.
So a history course. And
I would kind of like to learn the Tlingit language more since I don't know much besides like Gunishtish. And I think it would help me understand a lot more.
You know, we're really close to having a major in Tlingit language at the University of Alaska Southeast. Lance Twitchell is just driving toward that program, and he's right on the raw edge of it. He's got it, I think, well ensconced in the School of Arts and Sciences up there, so it's going to probably be possible to maybe take that course right here in Juneau, which would be really, I think, a great plus for the possibility of a major in the language. So, well, I want to thank you both for two things. One, for taking your part of your high school education and turning it into this wonderful opportunity, and for coming on the show and telling the rest of us about this. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Chicago's Michigan Avenue. Glass skyscrapers, fancy shops, the last place you'd expect to see a bird that normally hides in freshwater marshes. Yet, during spring and fall migration, like millions of other birds, secretive Virginia rails pass over the city at night. That is, until they hit a building or become confused by lights. Annette Prince, director of the all-volunteer Chicago Bird Collision Monitors, tells of rescuing one of these slim 9-inch-tall birds from a busy city sidewalk.
Pedestrians in the area were walking right past it, not even noticing it, and it's a fairly large bird. So I followed behind the people, and the bird just kept walking, we were able to catch it. This bird was very confused, very disoriented, and it turned out when it was taken to the wildlife center that it did have trouble flying, so it, you know, got x-rays and treatment for whatever trauma it had incurred in the urban area. But to see a bird that is so elusive and secretive in the marshes, and this bird is walking down a sidewalk, it's heartbreaking because you realize that these birds can't find any direction to go. One direction there's traffic, another direction there's glass. There are predators that are ganging up on them. Some of these larger birds have groups of crows and gulls that just come after them because they're sitting targets. They're vulnerable. They're very disoriented. And it's something that we experience every day when we're downtown finding these birds in the early morning hours.
You can follow Annette to the rest of the story and learn more at birdnote.org.
This is KTOO Juno. You're in tune with. We also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. On K276 AF at 103.1, we're in the Valley and Auk Bay. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek on K269 AO, it's 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear the signal on 89.9 megahertz over K210 AS. You can also get KTOO on JCI Cable Juno at digital channel 871. KRNN is heard on channel 872 and KXLL on 873. Pat Moore, I've been your host today for Juno Afternoon. I really enjoyed bringing you a set of wonderful guests, and I invite you to tune in tomorrow.
Tonight on 360 North, 2 hours of news and weather begin at 6. At 8, Sustain Angoon puts renewable energy to work where it's needed most, using a demonstration house, weatherization techniques, and renewable energy design to help create energy independence. Native Report is at 8:30 with the documentaries For the Generations, Native Story and Performance at 9, and Arctic Air, A Greenlandic Journey with the 109th at 10. All tonight on 360 North.